different kinds of certitude. There are different kinds of certitude, and Wilhelmsen summarizes them as follows. A, metaphysical, wherein there is absolutely no possibility for the truth of the opposite. Physical and moral, wherein there is a remote possibility for the truth of the contrary, but we have no sufficient reason to think this possibility will be fulfilled in the situation at hand. Now, we would normally call that absolute certainty and moral certainty, but it amounts to the same thing. Metaphysical certainty is absolutely no possibility of the opposite. There's absolutely no possibility of the opposite of I exist. What if I exist? As I can't exist and not exist at the same time. There's absolutely no possibility of the opposite of everything in the universe is either one or many. In a further distinction, Wilhelmsen points out that a man can possess intellectual certitude about a proposition and still fail to possess subjective or emotional certitude. The equivalent in our lingo would be, you can have security without having assurance of your salvation. You can be convinced that the Bible teaches that you're saved and eternally secure, but have the emotional insecurity as to whether you're saved. You could lack assurance even though you knew you had security. He can emotionally fear the opposite. You could be fully convinced of the doctrine of eternal security and just wonder whether you're going to go to hell. Just at times have doubts about it. He can emotionally fear the opposite even though he cannot think the opposite to be a possibility. Man can be absolutely certain that God exists and still feel his absence. Fourth, and this is tricky, certitude in error. Is it possible to be certain of things of which you're wrong? To have subjective certitude, feel that you're right and yet be wrong. St. Thomas even acknowledged that a man may be certain that something is true when in fact he's not. Now, certitude, not certainty, that's objective, certitude of adherence does not belong properly to the act of faith. First, because it also belongs to the intellectual virtues of science, wisdom, and understanding. Then, because it is common to both true and false faith. For men do not adhere any less firmly to truth than to falsity. That's a very astute observation. In fact, I would like to write a book, probably won't get around to it, right on the tail end of Dave Hunt's book entitled The Reason for the Seduction of Christianity. And the reason for the seduction of Christianity is that we have the wrong kind of epistemology. We have an experiential epistemology rather than a rational epistemology. And Aquinas is hitting at this point right here. Did you ever notice that cults, fanatics, and heretics have just as much certitude about their faith as do the Orthodox? So there is such a thing as certitude in error. However, it should be carefully noted, St. Thomas is not speaking here of intellectual certitude about first principles. About that, there can be no error. But about matters of faith, which are not rationally demonstrable, he is speaking of certitude of adherence or tenacity, not veracity. So you can have a certitude of tenacity without having a certainty of veracity. Nevertheless, St. Thomas does admit that error seems to be even more natural to men as they actually are than knowledge, because men are easily deceived and because the soul is longer in error than in truth during its lifetime. That doesn't sound too much like the guy who started modern humanism, does it? Pretty strong view of depravity. Wilhelmsen lists the causes of error as follows. Disease sensation, imperfect sense organ. Incomplete consciousness resulting from lack of union between the intellect and sensation, or burning the candle all night, will produce very similar sensation. The drive of the will toward the good, The necessity to act without compelling evidence in the practical order, these are all the causes of error. Well, let's analyze them. Why is it that people come to absolute certitude about things that are wrong? Well, you can have a diseased sensation. You can have an imperfect sense organ and not perceive it correctly and think you're perceiving it correctly. What would be an example of that? Color blindness is a good example. You have to have an improper organ for this particular one. I think yours might be another one. An improper organ. Color blindness would be an example. Incomplete consciousness resulting from lack of union between the intellect and the senses.
Mind-body problem.
Your senses sensed it, but the connection between your mind and what your senses sensed is quite loose because of the lack of proper union there. Could be proper sleep, could be proper anything, but your mind, your senses are sensing it right. They're not colorblind. But your mind is not picking up, connecting clearly with what your senses are sensing.
Dyslexia.
Yeah, that kind of thing, sure. That's a mental problem. Dyslexia is a mental problem. You're seeing things in reverse order and so forth. Your senses are picking up right, but your mind is doing it. That would be another example. And the third one, the drive of the will toward the good. How does that do it? The drive of the will toward the good sometimes gets you into error. Your desire gets ahead of your mind. Your will drives toward the good, and you're so zealous to get this that you go in, you allow your mind to make mental errors because your will is too zealous to want to believe it. You want to believe it so badly that you don't think it through as clearly as you should. The necessity to act without compelling evidence in the practical order. Everyday life, you've got to make a million decisions and you can't get absolute proof for them, so you're so accustomed to making decisions built on partial evidence that it's easy to make errors and assume that you've got absolute truth. But whatever the cause of error, it's not a question of error with regard to first principles. You cannot be wrong with regard to first principles once you understand them, once you understand the terms. If you understand what husbands mean and what married men mean, you don't have any choice and you can't be wrong. All husbands are married men.
Are first principles the only thing concerning which we can have objective certainty?
Or things demonstrable from them. See, you can only have objective certainty, proof, of first principles or things that are logically or rationally, inferentially, irresistibly, whatever you want to say, derived from them.
And I guess at each stage along the game, you have subjective certitude.
Well, take a proof for the existence of God. Aquinas believes that every premise is self-evident and the conclusion necessarily follows from the premises. So he believes that the conclusion, God exists, is demonstrated, proven. Now, whether he's right or wrong for now isn't the point. The point is that's what he believes, yes. Assent to certitude is always a conscious process. It's true that Aquinas speaks of an unconscious natural inclination to the truth, but it would seem that, properly speaking, the assent to certitude is a conscious activity for this reason. One can only be certain if he knows that the truth is a first principle or reducible to it, which necessitates a rational awareness. Accordingly, Aquinas always makes it a prerequisite of assent that the relationship between subject and predicate be perceived as a necessary one. And this would answer a lot of the objection that's given by modern fideists or coherentists against foundationalism. A principle, a lot of people don't perceive the connection between the subject and the predicate. So you'll get people say, this isn't self-evident to me. That's because you don't perceive the connection. But if you perceive the connection, it would be self-evident to you. So a lot of work has to go in to getting people to perceive the connection between a predicate and a subject in a self-evident statement. They just don't, you know, back to every finite thing has a cause. That is not, on first blush, a self-evident first principle. Every finite thing, because finite and cause just doesn't automatically grab you as all husbands and married men grabs you as self-evident. All husbands and married men grabs you immediately. But every finite thing has a cause doesn't grab you. You have to analyze finite. But once you come to understand that a finite could not be or could be, but is, and understand that, then you can see it must have been caused to be rather than not be, because it is when it could equally not be. Certitude, that subjective certainty, so to speak, certitude is a repose, say that over, certitude is a repose, a resting in the good possessed. Since certitude involves a conscious assent to the certainty of the truth for which man has an unconscious appetite, then the possession of this truth by the intellect is the reward of certitude. As Regi put it to reflection, certitude appears as a repose in the possession of this good, a sort of partial beatitude of the intellect caused by the presence of truth, of which nothing in the world could ever deprive it. The reward of the hunger for truth is the meat of certitude, which one consciously enjoys when he perceives the certainty and necessity of the truth possessed. I think that's a beautiful illustration, and it's borne out in your own experience. You labor over a topic, you come to understand the truth in that topic, and you just somehow enjoy that, the intellectual delight of discovery. You just rest in it, you repose in it. The beatific vision will be like that. You've been seeking the absolute good, and then you meet God face to face, and the absolute good fills you. You just rest in it, repose in it, delight in it, enjoy it forever. So in this world, the pursuit of truth gives you little beatific visions, little foretaste of glory divine. When you find one, you got it, you grab a hold of it, you sink your teeth into this steak, this absolute delicious sirloin or prime rib steak. If you didn't have that, what would impel you to learn? I, for the life of me, I can't figure out how anyone who doesn't believe that truth is knowable and can somehow be attained in some degree in this life ever studies anything. Why? Why would you study anything? What are you going to get? What are you looking for? How do you know when you find it? When you find it, how do you know you've got it? And if I were an existentialist like a Sartrean or Camus or one of those, I think I'd commit suicide for that. That doesn't make any sense. And you wonder why so many people are jumping off the cliff. It has a lot to do with the fact that in the modern world you can't be sure of truth or value, and therefore you never have anything to repose in here or to look forward to there. The ontological basis for first principles. And Aquinas has a unique solution to an old problem. And the old problem is, what is the actual basis in reality for first principles? Are they arbitrary? Are they based in reality? If they're based in reality, are we born with first principles? Are they innate? They just bubble up from within? Are we born a blank slate? If so, how could we ever know first principles? If we're born with a whole bubbling store of ideas, how come there's no evidence for that? What is the relationship between first principles and the nature of man? That first principles are based in reality. For Aquinas, it was sufficient that we know being, or that we know being, and that in reality our knowledge of first principles is based on our most fundamental knowledge of being. Thomas saw no need to justify this knowledge any more then one could demonstrate a first principle. Well, let's start there. You can't prove a first principle epistemologically. You just have to see it self-evident. In the ontological realm, that's true as well. The statement, I know being, is a first principle ontologically. I know being. How do you know that is true? How do you know it's a first principle? Just analyze it. Know. Being. What is being? Being is that which is knowable, which is intelligible. I know being. You start unpacking what know means and what being means, and you see that I know being must be true. Or take the undeniable route. I don't know being. A statement is self-defeating. You'd have to know something about being in order to say that you couldn't know anything about being, in which case you do know something about being. So fundamental, he doesn't attempt to prove that you can know reality. That's a fundamental premise you can't deny. If you deny it, you're implying it. If you look at it, you can see it's true. First principles are all reducible to the principle of contradiction. We don't need to go through this. Again, the principle of contradiction is built on the principle that being is not non-being. We don't need to state that again. How we know that first principles are based in reality? Here we've already given the answer to that. We know it because it's undeniable. We know it because it's self-evident. The conclusion is first principles are actually undeniable, whether they're simply in the epistemological realm or the ontological realm. The real question remains to discuss the epistemological origin of first principles. Where do they come from? Am I born with them? Are they written on my mind later? And here is a real dilemma. It's one of the most important problems in epistemology. Take any first principle. Let's use the law of non-contradiction. Where did you get the idea of the law of non-contradiction? Where did it come from? Were you born with it? If you weren't born with it, how could you know it if you weren't already using it? Suppose you were born a blank slate. Total tabula rasa. And floating in from somewhere comes the law of non-contradiction. How are you going to recognize it without already having it? You can't recognize it if you don't have it. If you already have it, then you must have been born with it. This is one of the strongest arguments for innate knowledge. On the other hand, if it's innate, if the law of non-contradiction, all these other first principles are innate, then there must be innate ideas. How come we seem to learn all of these? How come everybody doesn't seem to have them innately? What do we do with the empiricist David Hume's arguments that there's no evidence that we have them until we first have some sense experience? What do we do with the basic premise of Aquinas that all knowledge begins in the senses? That nothing is in the mind which was not first in the senses? To put it internally in terms of Aquinas' system, isn't it contradictory to say that there is nothing in the mind which was not first in the senses? And hold at the same time that there is an innate ability to know first principles. How can you know them without using them? If you're already born with them, then knowledge didn't start in the senses. And it's this dilemma that caused Stuart Hackett in his otherwise brilliant book, The Resurrection of Theism, to misinterpret Aquinas. He didn't see how Aquinas really reconciled this. And there are a lot of people who think Aquinas is a pure empiricist, like Locke or Berkeley or Hume, and they say he could never have absolute knowledge because he's an empiricist, like Aristotle. Everything begins in the senses. They forget that Aquinas was Aristotelian in his terminology, but he was very Augustinian in his theology, and that he did have innate something. We'll get to what and therefore he could solve the problem. And they miss a whole series of passages in Aquinas where he deals with this very problem. Yes, the Kant, I should bring my crossroads chart. Kant is the crossroads of modern philosophy, and there are two groups coming into him, the rationalists and the empiricists. The rationalists were people like Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. The empiricists were people like John Locke, Bishop Berkeley, and David Hume, in that order. Kant died in 1812, just to get some figures in here. Hume died in 1776. The rationalists stressed the innate. They stress what's called the a priori, that we know things independent of experience. The empiricists stress the blank slate, tabula rasa, and that all knowledge was a posteriori, begins in experience. The rationalist said that you are, your mind is born full, and these empiricists said your mind is empty. And that was a debate that raged until Kant synthesized it, and Kant said, here is the solution to your problem. The rationalists are right with respect to the form of knowledge. The empiricists are right about the content of knowledge. That you are born with an a priori innate form or category, forms of sensation, categories of understanding. But all of the content of your knowledge comes through your senses. You're born with a structure. It's already inbuilt structure, but all the stuff comes from experience over here. And so Kant said, you're both right. The empiricists are right about stuff and content. The rationalists are right about structure and form. And he put it together, and the result was agnosticism, philosophical agnosticism. You can never know what it was before you formed it. All you know is after you form it. You can never know what a thing in itself is. You can only know the thing to you. You don't know the Ding an sich. You just know the Ding für mich, or something like that. My German pronunciation not too great, but Kant's English wasn't too good either. So we have a total philosophical agnosticism about ultimate reality built on this ingenious synthesis. He rejected what is called the pre-formation theory. And this is why Stuart Hackett, whom I think is one of the most brilliant evangelical philosophers who ever lived, Stuart Hackett was so brilliant in his Resurrection of Theism. The whole first part of the book just critiques Kant. He says, here's a guy whose whole philosophy was built on the rejection of what's called the pre-formation theory, that the mind is pre-formed to fit reality, which is really what Aquinas believed. And Kant dismisses the whole thing in a couple pages, doesn't give any credence. He's got a 700-page book, his whole view rests on this, and he dismisses this in practically nothing. Aquinas would say to Kant, who are you to say that the categories, forms, empty to be sure, don't fit reality? How do you know the forms of your mind don't fit the forms of reality unless they do fit the forms of reality so that your mind can make some informative statements about reality? So all Aquinas' answer to this whole problem is very simple. You are born with certain forms or category, empty to be sure, but innate, instinctive, natural, synderesis type categories. And even though you're not born with the law of non-contradiction already there as a stated proposition, an idea in your mind, you're born with a non-contradictory predisposition 2. And therefore you can understand the principle when somebody spells it out, because you know by way of inclination before you know by way of cognition. You know by way of your natural bend toward truth before you know when you're thinking about or cogitating about this truth. So he has the best of both worlds, innate inclination, but only sensible cognitions. Aquinas' solution is, I know first principles because God created me in his image as an intelligent being which can know reality, and by very nature, before I ever get any principles in my mind, I am built that way to know these principles when they come to my mind.
What if someone has different inclination than what we have been discussing, and the first principles would be different?
If you could prove.
When someone perceives reality not as being, but as becoming, which would alter the first principles that he may have, other than the law of identity or contradiction. So how do we reconcile those?
If you could prove that, it would be a refutation of Aquinas. If you could prove that some people truly have a different inclination, an irreducible first principle, different inclination, without involving yourself in any self-falsifying, self-stultifying statements.
But then you're using the criteria which is based on your own first principles to adjudicate or to judge others' principles.
That's exactly right, because they are self-evident and undeniable. If he had a set of self-evident and undeniable principles, he could do the same thing. So if he can come up with a set of self-evident, undeniable first principles, which are the opposite, logically opposite of these, then we would be in an ultimate fideistic shouting match, right? Because all I could do is stand on my self-evident first principles that I know being, and he'd stand on his, so you don't know being, you only know becoming. But see, what I say to him, let's take the two and show how it's not a shouting match. I know being, and with that, I also know that it's not non-being. That's all implied in the system. It's also a first principle. Here's somebody who says, I don't know being. I know becoming. Now I think you can show that position two is self-defeating, that it has to borrow some of my first principles in order even to articulate its statement. It has to borrow, to make the statement, I don't know being, it has to borrow the premise that I do know being in order to even make that statement intelligible.
What if there is a third affirmative other than doing being? The third one would say, I know being, which is becoming.
Then I have to show that being and becoming are mutually exclusive statements.
Are they?
Well, I'd have to show that. If they aren't, then they would be identical, or the law of non-contradiction wouldn't apply, and we're back to a first principle. It's either being or becoming, but not both being and becoming at the same time in the same sense. That is not to say that you can't get a being that has something about it that is becoming, but it can't be essential to its being. It'd have to be accidental, like I am changing in size and shape and knowledge. That's accidental. But suppose you say, I, my very essence, is something and is not that at the same time in the same sense. And you'd have a contradiction, and the law of non-contradiction is undeniable or self-refuting. So if they affirm both of those and they mean something different, then you have a contradiction. And you're right back to arguing, does the law of non-contradiction apply to reality? And I would argue they can't use it here without borrowing it from here. They can't use it here without, they can't deny it here without using it in their statement there. Where I don't have to do that, in mine, my statement isn't self-defeating. I know being is self-evident, not self-defeating. Their statement, I don't know being, I only know becoming, is self-defeating and not self-evident. If we said that, let's do two things. Let's answer your question, both levels. Logic does not apply to all of reality. That's what one statement is, because reality is always bigger. What you have is logic does apply to this much of reality right here. Let's call that R1, but it doesn't apply to R2. And R1 usually turns out to be finite reality, and R2 turns out to be infinite reality, but it wouldn't matter. That boils down to saying that the laws of logic do not apply to, let's call it infinite reality or some kind of reality there. That's exactly what Van Til says, incidentally, and Dewey Beard, two notable Christian philosophers, that the laws of logic do not apply to God. They apply to finite reality, but ultimately don't apply to God. That very statement is self-defeating. That the laws of logic don't apply to reality is an application of the laws of logic to that very reality of which you're saying it doesn't apply. So the statement becomes self-defeating. And apply it to all reality, and this is one way to prove that it's not really a principle of all reality, because if you take L4 and bring it up here and you apply it to all of reality, then what do you end in? A contradiction, because you say an uncaused being is caused. Because if you apply the law of non-contradiction to God, God is an uncaused being, then you're saying the uncaused being must be caused, so you've ended in a contradictory statement, which can't be true. So that's how we know that you can't put that up there, and it must apply only down here. Because if you do try to put it up there, it truly ends in a contradiction, and no contradictory statement can be true. But this statement, the law of logic applies to reality, is not a contradictory statement. It's self-evident, undeniable, and not contradictory, so it legitimately applies to that realm. Good question. Yes?
Are we saying that, let's say, in the history of the truth, the unity and the, not division, but distinction in the essence is not contradictory to the laws of logic, but perhaps
yes, and thanks for bringing it up, because that was really the other half of his question that we didn't answer. In the Trinity, you have a divine with three persons, and in Christ you have a human nature and a divine nature in one person. So the law of the reason that the incarnation of Christ or the hypostatic union is not a contradiction is because the law of non-contradiction says that it cannot be and not be at the same time in the same sense. And the phrase in the same sense means in the sense in which he's divine, in the sense in which he's human. So you're violating the law of non-contradiction by assuming that whatever attribute applies on the divine side also applies on the human side, because Christ isn't human in the same sense that he is divine.
That would be another category mistake.
It's a category mistake. It violates the very principle itself, because the law of non-contradiction allows for differences in different senses and or in different times. Since he's simultaneously, that time wouldn't apply, but sense would apply. In the sense in which Christ is human, he got hungry. In the sense in which he's divine, he didn't get hungry. In the sense in which he was human, he got tired. In the sense in which he is divine, he didn't get tired. But those are different senses, because those are different natures. If he didn't have that distinction between nature and person, then it would be a contradiction.
Our problem comes from in time and space, and outside of time and space, trying to apply both at the same time.
No, the problem comes in, see, the law of non-contradiction says that opposites can't be true, one, at the same time, and two, in the same sense. And we're not talking about the time aspect there, we're talking about the sense aspect. We could talk about that. In fact, what does it mean at the same time? It really means simultaneous. It doesn't mean in time as opposed to in eternity. And God is simultaneous to time, so it wouldn't have a problem there. But the problem really is there's a different sense in which Christ gets hungry, and the sense in which he doesn't get hungry, namely a whole different nature.
So the problem of the Trinity, we saw that by talking about the essence, and then on the other side speaking of the person.
Same thing. And the problem of the Trinity is that God is a person in a different sense in which he is a nature. So he is three persons, and persons are different than nature. He is one nature and three person. He is one what and three whos. And who is different than what? And if you don't know the difference between who and what, I can't help you. The spade is turned. Or another way to say the same thing is that God is three relationally, but he is one essentially. And there's a difference between relational and essential. In fact, that whole difference is essential to understanding what's wrong with process theology. What's wrong with process theology is they don't understand how God can be relationally many and essentially one. How he can be relationally in time, but essentially in eternity. And they reduce God's essence to his relationships. See, what God is and what he does are two different things. He is his attributes. He does are his activities. He is unchangeable. He does changing things. So we can have our cake and eat it too. We can explain how God is relational with the world and yet is essentially unchanged in himself. Where a process theologian has to deny the top line. There is no being, there's only becoming. We're on the question of the origin of first principles, and we're treating the problem that emerges from Aquinas' belief that, first of all knowledge begins in the senses, and there's no question that he holds that. He said, but the human intellect is in potentiality with regard to things intelligible and is at first like a clean tablet on which nothing is written. And again, although the intellect is superior to the senses, nevertheless, in a manner it receives from the senses, and its first and principal object are found in sensible things. So everything that is in the mind started in the senses. But Aquinas also believes that there was one thing that didn't start in the senses, and that was the mind itself, which he calls agent intellect. In order to arise from sensation, which provides as such only a knowledge of singulars to a knowledge of universal principles. It's necessary to have the action of something that's superior to the senses, as the universal is superior to the individual. Such is the agent intellect. Although for Thomas, truth is not entirely from the senses, for the light of the agent intellect is needed, through which we know the truth of changeable things unchangeably, and discern things themselves from their likeness. The agent intellect in Aquinas is the mind with which you're created. It's that created mind that you individually have and that participates in the universal mind, logos doctrine, but which brings light onto the senses. If you only had senses, it would be like a blind man looking at a room full of furniture. The furniture is there, it's giving off sensations, but he doesn't see it. The mind is the light, and this light enables you to see, perceive the essences of the images that the sensations are bringing you. Now, you can be sensing stuff but not seeing it if you don't have an agent intellect which can see, the power to see the essence in those images. The possible intellect, it's another aspect of his epistemology, you have a storehouse where you can put those ideas, cannot have actual knowledge of principles except through the active intellect. For the knowledge of principles is received from sensible things, but intelligibles cannot be received from sensible things except through the abstraction of the agent intellect. In summary, the whole process of knowing first principles is this: for the first principles become known by the natural light of the active intellect. They are not acquired through reasoning, but only through this, that their terms become known, which comes about by this process. Memory is taken from sensible things, and experience is taken from memory, and knowledge of those terms is derived from experience. And when these terms are known, common propositions of this kind can be known, which are the principles of the arts and the sciences. Now let me summarize that. How can you come to know that this is a self-evident truth? All husbands are married men. Well, first of all, your senses would have to bring you the image of a man that you learn is a husband. You learn he's a husband because your senses tell you he has a certain relationship to another woman who is called his wife. All that knowledge comes from your senses. You have to experience that first, or you could never see the truth of the principle, all husbands are married men. Now, once your senses provide all of that, you have to have some mind to see the truth in that, because all your senses do is bring you a bunch of experiences. What is it that sees connections? How do you see those connections? You see those connections because you have an a priori, innate capacity to do so. And when that active mind looks at this data that your senses bring to you, and your active mind puts it together, all husbands are married men. How did you come to that self-evident conclusion? Through a combination of all the stuff came from your senses, the form came from your mind, and the proposition, the idea, resulted from that. So you weren't born with that idea. The idea resulted as a combination of the data coming to you through your senses and your mind, which God created, working on it and resulting in all husbands are married men. Think of it this way. Your mind is like a jello mold. Suppose you're born with star-shaped jello molds. They're all empty. The rationalists were wrong. They're not full. But when your experience brings you that...
real world. He believed it only matched the natural world, the world of your senses. So
Newtonian law of gravitation, because that applied to the physical world. But when you got to the metaphysical world, you ended in paradoxes and contradictions, and you never knew anything but time. So first principles arise from judgments that your mind makes with respect to data that your senses bring. Now, some problems. Critique an epistemological problem. How can first principles be known from sensation if we are pure tabula rasa? Answer, we're not a pure tabula rasa. In fact, this board behind me is not a blank slate. And I can illustrate that. Suppose you had a chalkboard and a piece of chalk and a white wall next to the chalkboard. If you take the piece of chalk, you can write on the chalkboard and you can see, make an X. You can see the X. If you go over and write on the white wall, you can't see the X. What's the difference? They're both blank slates. The difference is they're different capacities. One has the capacity to reflect the chalk back to you, the X, and the other one doesn't. So even a blank slate is not a blank slate, because it has certain capacities or forms to receive and relate. So your mind is born with certain capacities, propensities to reflect and relate, and it's not totally blank. So Aquinas said you're born with the capacity to know first principles, and you, when you see one, you'll see it because you have that God-given ability to see first principles. That's how they can be known from sensation. Next, what is this natural knowledge? Now, here's a whole set of passages that are almost totally unknown by critics of Thomas who don't study him. Thomas refers to the knowledge of first principles as natural knowledge, quote unquote, not knowledge by acquisition. The problem is, if these general principles must be known first in order to know other things, and if ultimately they find their origin like all things in the senses, are we not arguing in a circle? And his answer to that is no, because what is innate is not the first principle. Though he uses the word innate, Thomas used the word innate of first principles. He says the first principles of which we have innate cognition are certain likenesses of created truths. What's innate is our ability to know them, not the knowledge of them itself. Elsewhere, first principles are said to be acquired by a natural habit or a natural inclination or divinely instilled in us by God. Man is said to have natural knowledge of first principles or an understanding of first principles which follows human nature itself. He speaks of the mind being naturally endowed with principles not known by investigation, but which are bestowed on us by nature. Now, all of this natural innate knowledge would seem to be quite contrary to the clear assertion that all our knowledge begins in the senses. How can it be both a posteriori, from the senses, and yet a priori, or innate? The answer is, distinguish between an a priori inclination or form and an a posteriori content, and you have the solution to the problem. We have a precondition. We're born with a precondition for knowing first principles, an unconscious inclination in that direction, and later we come to know them consciously by putting subjects and predicates together and seeing if they are right. This inclination is not voluntary. It's an involuntary natural inclination or appetite for knowing them, and therefore Aquinas is a Kantian realist. Kantian in that he believes in innate forms, realist in that he believes, contrary to Kant, that you know reality. You're not left in an agnostic position about it. It would seem that for Aquinas, a man has an innate natural capacity or form for the truth of first principles ingrained into his very nature by God. He has first principles in a kind of virtual and natural way as a precondition of all rational activity. That is to say, one can only know first principles if he is exercising first principles to know them. Otherwise, he would have no means by which they could be known.
The two principles that are innate in your mind, how can you get the knowledge of being formed or impacted in a certain way by the sense of
sense? They are not that inclination that you're born with toward first principles is not impacted at all by the senses, except indirectly insofar as the senses bring you images and stuff that you put together by use of first principles. So if your mind brought you, let's say, John, if your senses brought you John, the man John, and his wife Mary, and you sensed that there was a man named John and you were wrong, if your mind put together John is Mary's husband, then obviously your use of first principle is indirectly impacted by the fact that your senses didn't bring you the right data. But on the other hand, the statement John is the husband of Mary is not a first principle, it's not a self-evident truth. Once you get a self-evident truth about that, John is a husband, John is a married man, your mind can't be wrong about that, even if it's wrong about whether John exists. Suppose John doesn't even exist. So your mind can be wrong about whether John exists, that your senses are bringing to you, but it can't be wrong about the fact that if John is a husband, John is a married man.
Another question about personality and
how does your personality impact first principles? Same way, not at all directly, except insofar as your personality will color the stuff that's brought to you, but when the stuff is brought to your mind, it will always work with regard to first principles.
What stuff is brought to you color your personality?
Whether the stuff of your senses, I think it does work that. I think it works both ways. I think your personality colors how you sense things, and your senses color your personality. But all that deals only with stuff. Your mind cannot be wrong about a first principle when it sees the first principle. It cannot be wrong about the fact that it knows being. It can be wrong about whether this being now exists, but it can't be wrong about whether being exists. It can be wrong about whether you are a contingent being, but it can't be wrong about whether something is a contingent being.
Since the forms in the mind correspond to forms in reality, is this principle of correspondence self-evident first principle?
Yes, because that's the same thing that we were saying before, that it boils down to the statement, I know reality. And the statement, I know reality, is undeniably true. Statement, I know being, or the mind corresponds to being, or being is intelligible. All those are equivalent statements. Being is intelligible, the mind knows being, the mind corresponds to being. All of those statements are self-evident because if you deny them, you imply them.
But Kant denies it. On what basis?
Kant denies it on two bases. One is the very epistemological gulf he builds by saying that you can only know the thing to me after it's formed. You can't know the thing in itself. And secondly, when you start to use first principles about reality, you end up in contradictions, paradoxes, antinomies. Now let's look at Kant's two things because they're very important. See how Aquinas answers them in advance. One of the great redundancies of the history of thought is that most of the great deviations from a realistic epistemology were answered in advance by people. In this case, Aquinas died 1300, kind of lived in 1800, so that's 500 years before. The first part of Kant's argument, that I can't know the thing in itself, but I can only know it to me, is self-defeating, because he's saying, I can't know the noumena. I can only know the phenomena. I can't know the thing in itself. I only know the thing to me. Well, how do you know you can't know the thing in itself if you don't know the thing in itself? It's a self-defeating statement. So Kant's first argument in favor of agnosticism is self-destructive. It's I know that I can't know. And if you know that you can't know anything about reality, then you must know something about reality to say that you can't know anything about reality. It amounts to saying, I cannot know reality. Well, the statement, it is true that I cannot know reality, is offered as a true statement that corresponds to reality. And if it corresponds to reality, then of course it defeats itself, because it's telling you the mind cannot correspond to reality by a statement of mind which corresponds to reality. The second one, contradictions turn out to be false dilemmas. And I'll just give you one or two examples of it, and you can apply it the rest of the way. If you look at his antinomies, they amount to this. Every thing must have a cause. Everything has a cause. Therefore, there must be a first cause. But if everything, second part of the antinomy, if everything has a cause, there can't be a first cause, because the first cause must have a cause too. Therefore, you end up in the contradiction by assuming that principle, everything has a cause, applies to reality outside of the empirical natural world. Assuming it applies to the thing in itself, the noumena realm, you end up in a contradiction. Everything has a cause, so there must be a first cause to get it going. If everything has a cause, the first cause must have a cause. Therefore, it's not there's not any first cause, because it has a cause, and so forth. Well, it can't be both first cause and not first cause. Contradiction, that should teach you, don't do that. Don't apply these principles to reality. Just be agnostic about it. Well, of course, his premise is wrong. We don't hold it everything. We only hold it every finite thing has a cause. And that is not contradictory. Once you say every finite thing has a cause, once you get to an infinite thing, doesn't need a cause. Only finite things need a cause. So you don't have a paradox, you don't have an antinomy or a contradiction, and every one of his antinomies is answerable. The best place to read the answers to them are either Stuart Hackett's book, The Resurrection of Theism, or Garrigou Lagrange, in our notes earlier, one of the early Thomists, who has a book on Aquinas, The Nature and Existence of God. In fact, he has several volumes, but he has answers to all of these and then we have them also in our Philosophy of Religion book and in the Apologetics book, a brief form of them.
Going back, just to help me see the distinction better, if you make a brief little chart illustrating the differences between the Thomistic epistemology and the rationalist epistemology.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the difference between, let's make a gulf here, let's take Kant's gulf and make the chart and put reality over on the right side and our mind over on the left side, and the big gulf between them. And here's Aquinas on this side, and here's Kant, and we'll make them into the... They both have minds, and they both have forms. We'll make a little square-shaped form and triangle forms in their mind. Here's Kant over here. He's got the same forms. He's got squares and triangles, and let's give him a circle, too. They've all got these little empty forms in their mind. And here's here's Kant. Now you draw lines from Kant's forms over to reality, and an arrow, and you say, can't. That form can't correspond to reality. So none of these forms here correspond to reality. So you've got the can. Whereas in Aquinas' case, it can and does. So there's not any significant difference over on this side, or there may be an argument about how many forms there are, how many basic first capacities for first principles there are. Is Kant's list correct, or is Aquinas' list correct? But when we're talking about the law of non-contradiction, the law of identity, and the law of causality, they'll all agree. Kant has those, Aquinas has those, so those basic ones are the same. They might argue about teleology, but they won't argue about identity, non-contradiction, excluded middle, unity, causality. Kant had all those, and Aquinas had all of those. Difference is that Aquinas thinks they correspond to reality. There is a pre-formation, that the mind is pre-formed, created, naturally disposed toward reality, and Kant thinks it isn't. Kant thinks the proof of it is, once you try and apply them over there, you end up in contradictions. Of course, he created the contradiction by stating the wrong premise to begin with.
Dr. Gosch, also, the difference between Aquinas in this respect and the rationalism of Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz.
Okay, let's draw them over here on the other side. Here we have a rationalist. Let's make Descartes or Leibniz, any one of them. Let's take Leibniz, draw him over here. He's got the same old things. He's got a square and a triangle, and he has a circle in his mind. And he thinks these things apply over here. So just like Aquinas, there are straight line arrows over there because he thinks his forms and categories apply to reality. The only difference is you got to fill in his forms, make them solid, because they've got content in them. You're born with the content in them. These other forms are empty, so you leave them open. While we got the diagram, we may as well put everybody on here. Let's put Hume over here. Here's Hume. No forms there at all. It's a tabula rasa. There aren't any empty squares, triangles, or circles. It's just a blank, blank slate. You can see he's in trouble. That's why he's a skeptic.
Which law is it that applies to one finite?
Causality. Because the law itself has in it all finite beings are caused. I mean, the law isn't a law about all beings. It doesn't pretend to be. Once you make it a law about all beings, you end up in contradictions. Sure as shooting. That's a good question. How to diagram Whitehead? Every time somebody asks me to diagram Whitehead, I remember Whitehead's, I think it was Lawrence, one of the famous commentators on Whitehead, who said about Whitehead, and he was a Whiteheadian, that Whitehead never feared to sacrifice coherence for comprehensiveness. In other words, he never let the fact that his model seemed to be incoherent bother him in incorporating everything into it. And I find it almost impossible to diagram these people. And I wouldn't know how to diagram Whitehead there. I'd have to think about it a good bit, and then if I'd probably come up with the same thing I came up with. You remember I had Jeff Amano do those worldview diagrams. You've seen my hands and worlds. I still don't like the one on process theology. There's got to be a better one than that. But I think, you know, at night I wake up thinking about stuff like that, and I haven't come up with a better model. It's just hard. It's hard to diagram something that is total process. See, his mind is in process. The forms, if you can, I can describe it. You diagram it for me. Here you have Whitehead over here, and he's got pliable, elastic process forms and process reality out there, and they're both in process.